This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Major League Baseball recently announced they'll require teams to provide housing for their minor league players starting in 2022. The historic change comes after more players have shared their experiences and hardships as minor leaguers. Today, we're talking about the challenges some minor league players face, from financial hardship to housing insecurity. We're joined now by Harry Marino, Executive Director for Advocates for Minor Leaguers, and Kieran Lovegrove, career minor league pitcher for the Rocket City Trash Pandas in Alabama. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Harry, we're going to get into some details throughout the show, but just to start out with a quick overview, what are some of the biggest issues minor league players are facing today?
Yeah, so look, minor league players have for decades faced a multitude of issues. At the core of the problem is drastically low pay. Minor league players make, you know, $400, $500, $600, $700 a week, and they only receive that salary during the season, 6 months out of the year, even though they are contractually obligated to perform services all year round. Beyond that, there are, you know, housing issues, food issues, transportation issues, just a general lack of a voice in their workplace. And others, you know, that we can go into, but those are the big ones. I would say the low pay is at the top of the list at this point.
Right. And so it sounds like it's salary and housing are some pretty big issues. How long have these issues been going around? Has it been since its inception?
Yeah, look, these issues have been in existence for a long time at this point. We haven't seen any real improvement in the treatment of minor leaguers for literally decades. And, you know, minor league pay has really, since 1975, failed to even keep pace with inflation. So things, if anything, have gotten worse over time, but the situation hasn't been good for quite some time.
Kieran, for folks who are tuning in and want to understand what a minor league player does, can you give us a little insight on what that career path is like?
Yeah, to put it simply, when you are first drafted by or signed as a free agent to a major league team and you are affiliated, you sign a 7-year minor league contract. That contract entails you to a certain amount of pay at each level. And once you get in, you are pretty much at the behest of whatever that team wants you to do. If you're going to show up for a instructs after the season, you have to show up. If you are called into an early camp prior to spring training, you have to show up. And none of those are paid. So, you know, the life of a minor leaguer is that which is entirely at the command of a major league team, but yet you're not actually getting the payoff for all the work that you're putting in.
So help me to understand this, because I'm thinking that if major league is involved, somehow it's got to be a little bit more glamorous, but it sounds like it's not at all.
No, I certainly wouldn't say that it's a glamorous lifestyle. I think because of how the MLB has set itself up with its antitrust laws, they've been allowed to exploit minor league players' talents for decades. You know, I've been talking to staff members who were playing in the minor leagues 35 plus 37 years ago, and their paychecks were only $200 less than what we're receiving now in 2021. The system has not been updated to keep up with the continuing increase of talent and performance in baseball. And so the system now is not conducive to athletic performance or success in those minor leaguers who cannot afford proper housing, proper food, or to be able to save up any money to feel like they have any stability in their life.
Mm-hmm. So when you talk about being drafted and then I'm just trying. Yes, I'm gonna say this. I don't know much about baseball. I've gone to games, but I don't know much about the backstory. So when it comes to getting drafted and then you get put on a minor league team, is that a way for the major league team to hold on to you so you don't go elsewhere?
Contractually, you can't. Contractually, you're under control for 7 years, your first draft year and then 6 years following. During that time, you only receive minimum pay, which is, as Harry said, not a lot. It's a couple $100s every week. Yeah, there really isn't a ton of wiggle room in those first 7 years. You can be traded at any moment. You can be released at any moment. You can be, you know, moved up, moved down. If you start a year in, let's say, high A in one city in one part of the country, and 3 weeks in, they move you up to another city, you still are responsible for whatever housing situation you had in the previous city, and then you have to find housing in the new one. So the whole situation can be a bit of a nightmare at times.
Yeah, that definitely sounds stressful, not knowing where you're going and just having to fly by the seat of your pants, basically.
Yeah, it's a complete external locus of control for the most part. You know, and I think that that has led to a bit of a mental health crisis in baseball, where these players who are extremely talented and high level individuals are not being treated with nearly the care and respect that they deserve for the hours and the you know, risk that they take upon their body to try and play this game, this elite echelon of play.
It seems like there's been a lot of talk recently with athletes and mental health and trying to put more of a focus on that. And we'll get to that in a little bit. But I do want to ask, Harry, how does the draft impact the future of a player, how they're going to be paid, what their trajectory is like?
Yeah, so listen, the draft is a unique thing in sports. And, you know, I'm an attorney, so I often try to, you know, think about things through the lens of a lawyer. And, you know, if you think about it, it's really a unique situation to be drafted into, you know, your employment situation and then be stuck with that employer for a period of time. If you, you know, I just think of like, if you were drafted out of law school, for instance, by a firm, didn't have any choice about where to go in the country, didn't have any ability to negotiate your pay, were just stuck, you know, with that law firm in whatever town, in whatever county, whatever state in the United States, at whatever pay for the next 7 years, I think that would turn some heads. I think people would be like, huh, that's pretty odd. That's what happens in baseball. And, you know, Kieran referenced baseball's antitrust exemption. I think that's a really important bedrock sort of part of what's going on here. So just to back up really quickly, you know, there are federal laws that prevent monopolies from forming, you know, and accumulating too much market power. One of the things that a monopoly would do is fix wages, and that is not allowed. So to use the law firm example, you know, if a bunch of law firms got together and said, we're going to pay all of our associates $8,000 a year for the next 10 years. But hey, in 10 years, one in 10 of them will make partner and make $1 million a year. So it's fine. I think people would say no dice. That's no good. That's what we have here in baseball, because baseball is the only sport that is not subject to those federal anti-monopoly, you know, antitrust laws. And so there's a lot, you know, once you start digging and you start thinking about that and how that might play out in some other industries, it really does not make a lot of sense. And a lot of the mistreatment and the specific issues that we can talk about here today emanate from that antitrust exemption.
I definitely want to touch on the antitrust. We have a few minutes before we have to go to break, but I do want to say, Kieran, you know, how would you argue with someone who would say, well, why did you even go into minor league if you knew that the pay would be so low, and sign your life away to 7 years?
For me personally, it's because I love the game of baseball to a point that is almost certainly irrational. And I think that that would be pretty common with most baseball players, and that our love and our attachment to the game forms at such a young age that the analogy that I've used consistently is that if you dangle the carrot in front of us, we are going to continue chasing it until exhaustion. And that's what a lot of players do, is they play and they chase the dream up until the point in which either their mental health or their physical health prevents them from continuing on, or if they have financial constraints. One of the, you know, frustrating analogies that constantly gets used to describe minor league baseball players is, oh, well, it's an internship. But nowhere else on the planet do you have an internship in which the people who are coming in as quote unquote interns operate at a level that is equal to, let's say, the CEO. If you take one of the better players in the major leagues and a solid minor league player, their difference in ability is actually pretty minute. It's the consistency and the mental game and the ability to do it day in and day out that makes the difference between a minor leaguer and a major leaguer. And so, you know, when people say, oh, well, why did you go if, you know, the pay is bad, or you get to play a game, you shouldn't be paid for it. I don't know that they fully realize the extent at which these players have trained their body to move at an elite level and the work and the time and the sacrifice that goes into that during the amateur stage of our careers, that now we have another 7 years of what is essentially less than amateur pay, because we're for a good amount of players paying money to play the game. If you have a family, if you have a mortgage, if you have car payments, insurance, cell phone bills, anything that is a recurring cost over time, it chews through that. It chews through the paycheck extremely quickly. And a lot of guys just cannot keep up with it and they end up losing money throughout the year.
It sounds very similar to sort of like the entertainment industry or any other place where when you want to break in, there's folks who are ready to take advantage or exploit your passion. Because they'll know you'll do anything to do your craft, to do something that you love. Would you say it's similar in minor league baseball?
Yeah, I think one of the actual clauses in that antitrust exemption or in the Save America's Pastime Act is that we are either quote-unquote seasonal employees or artistic employees, in that what we do is a creative outlet and not a skill. It's one of the most bizarre clauses I've ever read, and I wish I knew it word for word, but to make the statement that a baseball player is an artist or a seasonal employee, I think is a pretty ridiculous claim.
Well, is this different than the major league clause? Is there a clause in there similar to that? We have about 30 seconds.
Yeah. With respect to antitrust, that is something that applies across the board in baseball, but it was actually repealed by Congress with respect to major league players in 1998, in a piece of legislation called the Curt Flood Act of 1998. So right now, minor leaguers are, you know, enduring the downside of this antitrust exemption, but major leaguers who already have a union and high pay are not.
We'll be back with our guests after a quick break. We're talking about challenges faced by minor league baseball players and efforts to improve working conditions. If you have any questions or comments for the show, you can let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. The working conditions for minor league baseball players are making headlines as players have started opening up about facing financial hardship and housing insecurity. We're back with Harry Marino, Executive Director for Advocates for Minor Leaguers, and Kieran Lovegrove, career minor league pitcher for the Rocket City Trash Pandas in Alabama. Harry, we're touching on the antitrust laws and the relationship with major league baseball. Can you give us a quick summary of what exactly this all means?
Yeah, absolutely. So back in 1922, the Supreme Court said that baseball was not subject to the same anti-monopoly laws that apply to every other industry in the United States. And the reason for that is archaic, but basically at this point, nobody agrees that it's a good decision. And since 1922, a lot has changed. And every other sports league has been subject to those anti-monopoly laws. What that means in practice is that major league owners can sit around a table, draft up minor league players, decide how to treat them, decide how much to pay them, decide how long their contract should be, and agree not to compete for each other's players. So take someone like Kieran, very talented baseball player. He gets drafted by a team. You know, they decide we're only going to pay Kieran $500 a week. In a normal industry where the antitrust laws applied, that wouldn't work because another team would come in and say, hey, Kieran, you're only making $500 a week, you know, playing for the Angels. If you come and play in the Mets system, we'll give you $1,000 a week. That basic competition for services is so important for workers to recoup the actual value that they are providing to their employers. I mean, that's what the basic, you know, free market system that our country operates on is based on. And workers in every other industry get that, but workers in the minor league, in baseball, and specifically minor league players, don't get a fair market for their services. And so, you know, a lot of times people have said, wow, minor leaguers are treated poorly. we should give them, you know, the minimum wage at least. To me, I kind of reject that premise because minor league players on an open market would make way, way more than the minimum wage. They are providing tremendous value to their employers, both as prospective major league players and also as, you know, current minor league players who are performing in front of fans at a high level every day. And so, you know, it's a little bit of a hidden secret here that, you know, people don't know about, but this antitrust exemption, it's really pernicious. And it really is a big reason why minor leaguers are subjected to this extraordinarily depressed wage.
It's interesting that this was put together and hasn't been challenged, it sounds like, and it's just kind of swept under the rug.
Yeah, I mean, look, the way the Supreme Court works is once a decision is made, it's a really, really high bar to overturn it based upon, you know, the concept of precedent and stare decisis. And so what we have is a situation where the Supreme Court said something, you know, 100 years ago, and it stood for 100 years. It's going to be a really high bar to overturn it. I will say that there is growing optimism about the Supreme Court actually doing so. And that relates to the Supreme Court case this past spring, NCAA versus Alston, where the court basically opened up the gateway for college athletes to start making money off their name, image, and likeness. In that opinion, the Supreme Court cited a brief that we submitted, our organization, Advocates for Minor Leaguers, talking about baseball's exemption. And in doing so, the court actually mentioned the exemption in a way that really cast some doubt on it. It said this is a so-called exemption, and it really hasn't made a lot of sense. And so that's a signal, you know, for lawyers out there that maybe there is an opportunity to go after that antitrust exemption, you know, and maybe the Supreme Court, the current court, you know, the current nine members of the court at least have an appetite for reconsidering that antitrust exemption, because you won't be able to find one lawyer out there who can explain to you why it makes a bit of sense. It just doesn't. And at a certain point, you know, the fact that things have always been a certain way is not a very good justification for the kind of real world hardship that players like Kieran and thousands of others have endured for decades.
Kieran, what was it like for you when you got drafted and started your career in the minor leagues? Did you ever at a time feel like this isn't what you thought you signed up for?
Yeah, I think there were definitely times in my career where I looked around and said, this doesn't feel right to me. This doesn't feel like presenting an opportunity for players to better themselves and ultimately create an organization that is more likely to win baseball games. You know, my personal experience, I was not someone who was drafted in the lower round, so I actually got a good signing bonus. And, you know, I didn't have to struggle for the first few years. I was able to rent my own apartments. I was able to eat what I wanted. And I very quickly realized how much money that hemorrhages when your paychecks coming in to replace it are so little. And I started hemorrhaging through that money very quickly as a young, you know, 17, 18, 19, 20 year old with very little financial literacy. You know, I started realizing that this is extremely difficult to do if you're not someone who was paid a few hundred thousand dollars out of the draft. And the vast majority of players who come into minor league baseball are not paid more than $100,000 for their signing bonus. And then obviously you have taxes on top of that. So a lot of guys, that initial signing bonus goes straight into a savings account because it's all you have for the next 7 years if you don't make the big leagues.
And that's got to be hard, I'm guessing, because you're working full time in this field. Is there even time to get a second job?
So during the season, no. During spring, no. And during the fall, if you're in instructs, no. Most of the time, if you get a secondary job, it's a seasonal job that runs somewhere from September, October to right around February. A lot of guys do Lyft and Uber, or they work retail, or they work at warehouses. I've done all three of those things throughout my career. And the biggest issue is the jobs that are available or the hours that you have to work aren't necessarily conducive to your training schedule. And so it becomes very difficult to balance that, you know, training at an elite level, making sure that your body is in the right spot, making sure you're able to eat enough food to maintain your weight and your muscle mass and recover. And also going into work 8-10 hours a day putting that strain on your body and, you know, doing that just so you can keep your head above water so that you can afford the food that you need to eat to recover for the job that you're training for. It kind of becomes this vicious cycle of money in, money out, just to maintain the ability to play the game.
Have you heard from any major league players that are supportive of your cause, of bringing attention to this?
Yes, absolutely. I think probably one of the most prominent ones is Sean Doolittle. He has been a voice for positivity in the game for a long time. And he has continued to step up and support the movement. And there have been others, Jose Ramirez, Chris Taylor, they've worn the fair ball wristbands. Trey Mancini, I could go on and on. There are a lot of players who support this because there are a lot of players who have lived that reality in the minor leagues and have seen teammates, friends. I mean, these players and these teammates become like a family to you. And to watch them have to suffer through poor wages and not being able to see their family and having to eat, you know, less than quality food, and seeing that effect on their mental health, I think that has a pretty profound effect on most players, because it shouldn't be that way if we're trying to create a team or an organization that is that has the goal of winning in mind.
It's got to be complicated too. I'm thinking of the relationships where, you know, you have a teammate that goes on to the major league and they're getting paid much more and they're remembering where they came from. But at the same time, I'm guessing there's going to be guilt to be moving up and then everybody else is still getting paid really basic.
I personally wouldn't know. You know what I can say just from having a free agent deal. So after your 7 years of minor league contract, you're able to sign free agent minor league deals, which you can substantially increase your pay. Of course, it takes 7 years to do so. And there were times even when I was receiving substantially more than the other players on my team because I was on a free agent deal. And if I wasn't performing, I felt guilt during that time, because I almost didn't feel like I was worthy of that pay just because of what we've been so conditioned to. When one player is getting $1,500 a month and one player is getting almost $20,000 a month to be on the same team, that discrepancy can be a little uncomfortable.
Yeah, I mean, I can imagine that that's not a good feeling. Harry, you also played in the minor league for a couple of years. What was your experience like?
Yeah, so listen, my experience, and this was a little while ago, but 2012 through 2014, was consistent with, you know, Kieran's and so many other guys over the past few decades. I mean, I saw all of the same types of things firsthand, whether it was players, you know, struggling with housing, with meals, with, you know, making ends meet. You know, I've told this story before, but I vividly remember, walking into a teammate's, apartment, and they had five air mattresses laid on the ground in a one bedroom apartment. A pretty jarring thing to see, to be honest with you. Just not really a human way to live. I mean, honestly, I felt like those conditions were dehumanizing. And at the time we were only, you know, 45 minutes up the road from the major league team, which was, you know, worth, you know, a couple $1 billion. And I remember thinking, this just is not right on a fundamental level. Like, there are a lot of reasons why this shouldn't be happening from a performance standpoint, just from an economic standpoint. But in that moment, I remember feeling, this is just not morally okay. How are there people involved with this major league team that are okay with this happening down the road? Like, it just can't be the case. So it's really troubling. And, you know, I think something that is important to note is that the minor leagues are made up of a significant number of Latin American players, from Dominican Republic, from Venezuela, all manner of countries, a lot of very, very talented baseball players from that region who are signed and come to America to be a part of this system and are drastically underpaid. And there are a lot more Latin players, as many as there are in the major leagues, there are way more at the lower levels of the minor leagues. As you move up levels, it gets, you know, whiter and whiter and whiter. And that also was really problematic to me, to see so many Latin American players who didn't speak the language, who didn't have any advocates for them, didn't have any union representing them, living five guys to a one bedroom apartment. It just felt like very, very exploitative.
And it really, really bothered me.
You know, it's interesting. I was going to ask you about that. If there was sort of some kind of systemic problems within baseball that would lead to us saying that, you know, maybe there is a lot of exploitation at the lower levels because of the makeup of the team. Have you seen that changing over the years, or has it gotten worse?
So, you know, I'll give you an example, and it's not, unfortunately, a good answer. But so in minor league baseball, there's something called extended spring training, which is a period of from, you know, basically April until the draft in late June, when players who are not assigned out to a minor league team to go play games in front of fans stay back at the spring training facility and just train in the, you know, as they would during, you know, the off season and spring training, to just prepare for this season. Those players are, you know, the numbers are pretty drastic. There's a lot of Latin American players, that are in that extended spring training, setup. Historically, players at extended spring training don't receive any salary, even though they're working 6 days a week, going to the field, you know, all day, training, working out, playing, you know, all the whole nine. They don't receive any salary at all. And I can't help but think that part of the reason for that is that there are so many Latin American players who don't have a voice, who don't speak the language, who aren't going to speak up and complain about it. And to me, that has always been some of the most drastic exploitation in minor league baseball, because remember, you don't receive a salary all off season. So if you are one of these players who's assigned to extended spring training, you could go for an entire 12-month period, all of during which you are training, working for your employer, putting in hours to, you know, to try to become one of their major leaguers, and providing value to them in that way, you might only receive 3 months of pay. And that might amount to something like $3,000 for the entire year. And the fact that there are so many Latin American players in that situation, I think is something that is really, really problematic, and that Major League Baseball needs to take a hard look at.
Yeah, I mean, I'm honestly, I shouldn't say that I'm surprised, because nothing surprises me these days. But at the same time, I'm just speechless that this has been going on and nobody really knows about it.
Yeah. I mean, look, I think the reason that people don't know about it is for so long, there has been a culture of fear, of speaking up. As Kieran said, there's a carrot out there, which is one day I'll be able to make the major leagues and make it, you know, and become rich. And, you know, what they don't tell you is that's only going to happen for, you know, something like 10%, if that, of minor league players. For the vast, vast overwhelming majority of minor leaguers, that big payday is never going to come, and they're going to have been exploited as a result during their minor league years. And, you know, obviously something our organization exists to do is to embolden players to speak up, to draw attention to it. And, you know, I think it's worth mentioning that Kieran was one of the first players, if not the first player, to really put his name behind this and come out and say, this is how minor leaguers are treated. And it was so jarring that ESPN ran a story on it that was, you know, basically at the top of their page for a couple of days, because people were like, wow, they couldn't believe something that, you know, those of us inside the game have known for a long time. It's been a really, really well-kept secret, and it has taken players like Kieran and others who have been willing to buck that longstanding trend of staying silent in order to really start to raise awareness about it. And candidly, that's the only reason we're even on this show today having a conversation, is Kieran's bravery and the bravery of those like him who've said, it's time to stop suffering in silence. We have to draw attention to this, because anybody who hears what's really going on is not going to be happy about it, and is going to want to hold MLB to account, and is going to want to see some change. And, you know, a couple months later, we're starting to see that.
Well, Kieran, we have about a minute till we go to break. What was it that compelled you to speak up about this?
I think first and foremost, it is that deep kind of irrational love for the game. I got in about 10 years ago, and now coming out, realizing that the game hasn't really made any positive progress in that time irked me a little bit. And seeing the next generation continually come in year after year, the new draftees, and seeing them come in kind of bright-eyed and with all this hope, and then to see that kind of get diminished year after year when they realize the realities of minor league baseball, over time, that has really started to wear away at me and diminish my hope for the game. So now, moving forward, I just want to make sure that that next generation is completely taken care of, that they don't have to deal with the same struggles that we've dealt with for 40 years.
Well, we'll be back after a quick break. We're talking about the hardships and working conditions of minor league baseball players and efforts to improve them. If you want to get in on the conversation, you can leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881 or find us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Back now to our discussion on efforts to improve working conditions for minor league baseball players. We're joined by Harry Marino, Executive Director for Advocates for Minor Leaguers, and Kieran Lovegrove, career minor league pitcher for the Rocket City Trash Pandas in Alabama. Before the break, Kieran, we kind of touched upon you speaking up and taking on this challenge to bring attention to this cause. Did you get any pushback? As I've heard from Harry, there's a culture of fear kind of within the industry. So we're... you warned by anyone not to say anything?
Had I maybe taken any advice from anybody, I probably would have been warned. And in knowing that that was probably going to happen, I decided to do this pretty individually. I knew it was the right thing to do. I knew that there were massive risks to my career, not only as a player, but potentially moving forward if I ever wanted to work in a front office or be involved in the game in any way, that I was taking an enormous risk in doing so. In coming out and speaking out, I expected to have an enormous amount of backlash. I expected to hear from the owner or the front office. And really what I got for the first few weeks, month or so, was complete radio silence, which was a little off-putting, to be honest. And as the season started to wrap up on our final road trip, the GM and one of the special assistants to the GM actually came out to Birmingham where we were on a road trip. And we sat down and we talked for an hour and a half, hour 45, and just had very honest, very positive dialogue, trying to understand where the disconnect of communication was between the minor leaguers and the front office that were leading to at least what I was referring to, the specific issues in the Angels organization during that time. Mm-hmm. When I spoke up, I didn't want it to be a specifically Angels issue because it is not a specifically Angels issue. It is a league-wide and almost a collaborative effort by the owners and the central office to maintain the status quo. I think taking this kind of approach and taking a bit of a heavy-handed approach was the only way to circumvent kind of going up the ladder, so to speak, because I feel that doing that would have probably ended up with a lot of the information getting squashed or pushed to the side. I think that the fans of this game deserve to know what has been happening, and I think they deserve to see positive change that affects the players that they go and they support.
Hey, Harry, the MLB announced they're going to require teams to provide housing for minor leaguers starting next year. Is that a big deal?
Certainly, yeah. It's a very big deal. And, as we've kind of touched on, minor league players have traditionally lived, six guys to a 2-bedroom apartment, sometimes worse than that, sleeping on air mattresses. There's been countless stories of guys sleeping in their cars, in the clubhouse, really, housing insecurity, plain and simple. And if guys want to live in a more comfortable way, they're going to have to spend more than their whole paycheck to do so. Add into that the fact that minor league players are reassigned from one level to another at the major league team's whim. And, what you end up with is a system in which paying for and finding housing doesn't make one bit of sense, putting that on the player. And so that really has been an issue that the players, Kieran and others, and in conjunction with our organization, came together and said, we want to really fix this first and foremost this year. And we really were able to sustain conversation around that issue, both through social media, through traditional media, sharing photos, sharing videos, just sharing, tweets, just stories of what really was happening with housing. And as a result, fans were outraged. Some of these things, went viral. They got a lot of attention. And Major League Baseball was forced to make a change. And I can tell you that over the last, you know, few days, I have talked to dozens and dozens of players who told me that they breathed a huge sigh of relief when they heard that, because it was just a monumental burden on them that had been lifted. And I think it's a testament to their willingness to stick together and to speak out on an issue that really made some change. And I think that's historic in the context of an industry where workers have been exploited in silence. So yeah, substantively a very big deal and will make a big impact on players' lives. Also a really big deal for what it says about what minor league players can do when they put their mind to something, stick together, show solidarity, and speak out for what's right.
Kieran, how do you feel about the announcement?
Cautiously optimistic, I think, is the best way that I could describe it. I think it is an enormous win for the players, because even I have had conversations where players have just been thanking me because that particular source of stress was one of the largest, or that they'd had issues in the past where maybe they'd, you know, gotten into an apartment, been moved up, and then they were paying double rent. All those little things can really cause issue during the season. The reason I am cautiously optimistic is I do not want this to be one terrible system transitioning to a different terrible system. For me personally, I really want to make sure that this is done correctly, that for players to arrive in a city, all they have to do is receive a key to their, you know, whatever their domicile is, and they turn the key in the door and they drop their bags off, and that is the extent of their move-in. The situation to find housing is typically you end up knowing where you're going to go about 5 to 2 days before you fly out. And once you arrive in that city, you have 3 days of a hotel to find a place to live. So you are going from not knowing where you're going to live to having 1 week at most to find a place to live, sign the lease, get the security deposit paid, get your first month's rent paid, move in, get your internet set up, maybe find furniture. Most of the time you don't. And to do all that right before you start your first games for the season can be an enormous, enormous amount of stress. So for me personally, I just want this to be taken care of in a way that most effectively looks after the players, and all they have to do is turn the key and they're home.
I would think that Major League Baseball has enough money to set up some kind of a dormitory system for all the players to be housed all across the country. I don't know. That's just my thought.
They definitely have the funds to do it. I think the initial report from a few different teams was it was going to cost somewhere between $1 million and at the very most $5 million to house their minor leaguers. If you're familiar at all with just the pay structure of Major League Baseball, $1 to $5 million is a drop in the bucket to any team.
Yeah, I'm thinking, don't players make like $20 million or more in Major League?
Yeah, I mean, there were players this year who made almost $40 million who only made 10 starts. You know, there are plenty of instances in which money is just sort of thrown around at the top, and yet there is a massive deficit of funds at the bottom in certain organizations.
Harry, when it comes to money, why aren't minor leaguer players paid more? And the reason I'm wondering this is I'm guessing these team owners are making money off of these players.
Yeah, look, I think it comes down to they're not being paid more because owners don't have to pay more. And it comes back to that, you know, to that antitrust exemption, to the ability to set a artificially depressed wage for minor leaguers, and you know, they can get away with it, so they are all too happy to do so. Major league teams, I think the average major league team is valued at about $2 billion right now. You know, Major League Baseball is a very, very profitable entity, and those involved with owning teams are making a lot of money doing so. And as, you know, Kieran mentioned, those at the top, major league free agents, are also, you know, making a lot of money. But once you start, you know, digging in deeper, a lot of other people around the game, including most notably minor leaguers, are not making as much money. And it's really, you know, a problem, obviously, that we're looking to change here as we move forward. I think Kieran's point is a good one, which is, you know, our organization and players generally are going to have to provide oversight in regards to the implementation of the housing policy, because the details matter there. And it's important that we continue to oversee the implementation on that side. But, you know, with housing sort of in a big picture way being acknowledged, at least by the league, as something that needs to be addressed and on their plate, I think the next thing up is going to be this pay, you know, as the next issue.
Right now, the way it's structured, Harry, do you think that white players are paid more than other players in the minor leagues?
No. So the way that it's handled right now is the standard salary is $700 a week at AAA, $600 a week at AA, $500 a week at single A, and $400 a week at the spring training complex. And that, you know, standard rate is paid to all players at those levels, irrespective of any other characteristics, including how much they're actually worth to their team. You know, it's just that at the lower levels, you have more, diversity and less so as you move up. So, that is certainly noteworthy, but no, the actual rate of pay, is standardized across the game.
Kieran, you were playing in the minor league last year during the pandemic. What was that experience like?
It was strange. You know, the start of the year was very different to what we were used to. And I think we ran into more than a few just logistical issues with COVID. You know, meals had to be prepped and served individually. And the problem we were running into with that is that no player was getting enough calories from the meals that were provided. You know, we were getting, I think, about 1,400 calories a day provided, which is just barely above metabolic base minimum calories that you need to maintain brain function in a day. So the rest of that came out of our paychecks. And for, especially for guys, you know, big, strong, muscular, you know, whatever, if they're pitcher position player, it doesn't really matter. You know, we have guys who are 240, 250 pounds of muscle who need 3,000 to 5,000 calories a day. And that gets very expensive, especially when you're asked to not go to restaurants and you have to DoorDash, you have Postmates, and the fees add up and you're only getting, you know, $20 to $25 a day for meal money. And that only happens on the road. So all of these little factors add in, and it was definitely a more stressful year. A lot of, you know, new families, players who had kids during the pandemic who are now trying to navigate fatherhood and baseball, players who were not able to even see their children for 5-6 months a year during really what I would imagine extremely important and formative time during the child's development, but also during your time as a father. You don't, no matter how much you get paid, even if we were being paid, you know, $1 million, it doesn't buy you time if you can't have your family with you, if you can't effectively live in a way that allows for your family to be with you, to have your support systems. All those things being in place would absolutely make minor league life easier. It's just been impossible to implement due to suppressed wages, living situations, and so on.
Harry, what needs to happen for long-term changes to take hold?
So I think that there are really two big picture solutions here. One is, you know, the antitrust exemption that I've kind of talked about a lot, you know, over the last hour, right, could be taken away. That would obviously open up the market for minor league players. And we could, like, we could really start to see what would happen, you know, in a competitive market. And the other thing is unionization of minor leaguers, right? Almost all professional sports leagues have a unionized workforce at this point. Minor league baseball has been an exception for a host of reasons, you know, having to do with the geographic, you know, dispersal of the teams, the fact that there's a lot of turnover year to year, the culture of fear that we've talked about. All of those things have made unionization difficult. Obviously, with a union, minor league players would have a seat at the table and would be able to negotiate over things like pay and like the implementation of the housing policy. And so that would be a very effective way to solve this problem in the long run. And what I'll say is, while there are significant barriers, you know, like I just laid out, we really are seeing for the first time this season, minor league players act in a unified way, speak up on their own behalf, and start to really believe that things can change when they advocate for themselves. And so, you know, there's still a long way to go, and there certainly are are barriers in place, but I have more optimism as I sit here today about the prospect of minor league unionization than I ever have in the past.
Kieran, we mentioned housing insecurity and pay, but there's also the issue of mental health, and in particular when it comes to athletes and sports, we've been hearing more conversations about this. Do you think there's enough support in that area for minor league players?
No, absolutely not. I think to me that is one of the four pillars of athletic performance, and the four that I constantly talk about are sleep, hydration, nutrition, and mental health. And if any of those four pillars are compromised in any way, it can have a cascading negative effect on the player. In minor league baseball, typically you don't get to have a regular sleep schedule. Your nutrition is entirely provided by whatever team or affiliate you're at. So that can be another external locus of control that can lead to, you know, negative cascading effects. Hydration is something that's obviously taken very seriously in professional sport, and that's not something that I worry about too much. And then mental health. If you have guys who are away from their family, away from their wives, their kids, their parents, their support structures, they are dealing with things outside of the field that can affect their play. If they don't have anyone to talk to, if they're, you know, from my personal perspective, I had serious mental health episodes in my career, ultimately culminating in years of alcoholism and a suicide attempt in the winter of 2015. You know, I didn't feel like I had the resources to reach out and say, you know, completely separate from the actual game of baseball, I as an individual am really struggling with my mental health. And I didn't feel like I had anyone to reach out to, or I didn't know that I had the resources. I think making the culture of baseball more open to understanding how mental health affects our ability to play the game and teaching more players how better to handle those situations will ultimately lead to not only healthier players, but a happier system throughout.
What do you hope to see next as we get ready to wrap up here? What is your, I guess, ideal situation in the next, I don't know, year?
I want to see the players have a voice. I really do. I think that the minor league employee body is one of the largest employed by Major League Baseball, and there's a enormous amount of knowledge and ideas and novelty to come from that employee base, and I don't think it's being utilized as well as it should be. To me, it's an opportunity for MLB to open the doors and let, you know, minor league athletes come in and talk about their experience and their realities to find a more conducive system for athletic performance, mental health, to ultimately not only create better baseball players, but to create better people and, you know, to spread that positivity, not just from the players, but to the staff and the fans and everybody involved in the game, and to eventually do that on an international scale. You know, but in this next year, I want players to have a voice.
Thank you to both of you for joining us today. And Kieran, thank you for being so open and sharing your personal story. Harry Marino is the Executive Director for Advocates for Minor Leaguers, and Kieran Lovegrove is a career minor league pitcher for the Rocket City Trash Pandas in Alabama. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yace, and Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.